Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
Hollywood could go dark. IATSE threatening a strike over working conditions. The governor of Illinois cuts a vaccine deal with the laborers union. And today on the show, the latest from our government affairs director at the AFL-CIO and the American Federation of Musicians, Local 4. Welcome to the Thursday, September 23rd edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, as well as Pandora. And remember this, when you get an opportunity, just sign up and receive our shows on a regular basis and give us a rating. We always appreciate the best rating possible, and that would be a 5-star rating. We certainly have a 5-star guest today, one of my favorites, Bill Samuel, who is the government affairs director of the AFL-CIO, AFLCIO.org for complete updates. And he has a whole lot to talk about today. The latest on the budget reconciliation package, which is $3.5 trillion. I'll get into some details here. Infrastructure, that's a big one. In fact, we have a bipartisan deal. You should know that by now. And from all indications, that could be coming up for a vote soon. Bill's going to give us the details on that. The PRO Act, can't talk enough about that, making it easier for people to organize. And the fiscal cliff. Listen to this. The United States could plunge into an immediate recession. Why? If Congress fails to raise the debt ceiling and the country defaults on its payment obligations. And we're real close for that happening. Mark Zandi is a chief economist at Moody's Analytics, and he stunned everyone yesterday. He said a prolonged impasse over the debt ceiling would cost the U.S. economy up to 6 million jobs, wipe out as much as $15 trillion in household wealth, and send the unemployment rate surging to roughly 9%. Right now, the jobless rate is at 5%. So it could double. Lawmakers in both parties are saying, yeah, the debt ceiling must be raised to avoid what I just said. But there's a standoff. Despite the national debt increasing by close to $8 trillion under Donald Trump, the Republicans have been adamant that they will refuse to help the Democrats increase the debt ceiling. Why? Because they are opposing President Biden's spending plans. That's what's happening in Washington. Talk about a stalemate. Holy smoke. On that reconciliation package, that's the big holdup, because they don't want that to happen. And there's a lot of things in there that labor's pushing for. In fact, many are saying that labor, many unions, help craft the bill. In that reconciliation package, the bill would empower the National Labor Relations Board to levy substantial fines on employers who violate labor law. And right now, the board lacks the authority to penalize employers who interfere with unionization efforts. And it would also permit the board to conduct union elections online, which many labor leaders have said we're long overdue for. And all these are included in the PRO Act, and Bill will give us the details on this. I'm also reading that this bill would expand OSHA and the wage and hour division and the penalties that could be levied against employers who violate wages. Don't pay people enough, screwing them on overtime. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. Lots to talk about with Bill Samuel as our first guest. Len DeCosimo, who heads Local 4 of the American Federation of Musicians, will be our guest later in the show. Len's a great guy. He's on the board of the North Coast Area Labor Federation. And of course, he's been with the musicians a long time. A couple things he's going to get into: proof of vaccination for performance venues, for arts organizations, for employees and patrons. I know the Cleveland Orchestra mandated, this was about a month ago, that anybody that wants to come and see them, they have to show proof of vaccination or a negative test in some cases. We're also going to talk about grants for the fine arts, and many of those grants came through the American Rescue Plan to promote jobs in the arts sector, support performing arts venues, producers, arts organizations, all good stuff. And it kept them alive during the pandemic. By the way, this year is the 125th anniversary for Local 4 of the Cleveland Federation of Musicians, and Len's going to run down what they're doing to celebrate that. How do you celebrate that in a pandemic? Well, he's got a couple of ideas, and he's going to run that down. So Len DeCosimo will be our second guest right here on America's Workforce. Well, the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, better known as IATSE, they represent more than 150,000 workers in the entertainment industry. They have announced that they were asking tens of thousands of their members to approve a strike authorization vote. The statement comes after months of negotiations over a new contract, and those talks have deteriorated between IATSE and the major film studios, including Netflix, Amazon, Warner Brothers, and Walt Disney, which, by the way, are some of the wealthiest corporations on the planet. In recent months, anonymous online testimonies detailing the grueling working conditions endured by workers laboring on film and TV sets have gone viral, with many describing 15-hour workdays and chaotic, dangerous work sites. So, the IATSE leaders have been pushing for longer rest periods and improved wages, but they report that these major producers have refused to respond to their latest proposals and allowed the previous contract to expire. Comment here, the failure to continue negotiating can only be interpreted one way, the IATSE negotiating committee proclaimed in a statement which was released on Monday. We will now proceed with a nationwide strike authorization vote to demonstrate our commitment to achieving the change that is long overdue in this industry. Now get this. A strike in the entertainment industry has the potential to be historic. Why? Because the last major strike in Hollywood was nearly 8 decades ago. 80 years ago. The 60,000 members affected by the now expired contract could be asked to cast their votes as soon as October 1, which is a week from tomorrow. And the union would require approval from 75% of all ballots received to authorize a strike. You realize that would pretty much shut down Hollywood, don't you? It's amazing. First major strike that could happen in 8 decades. Let's go to Illinois. Illinois' Governor J.B. Pritzker, a Democrat, announced this week that his administration has reached an agreement with Labor's International Union of North America, Illinois State Employees Association Local 2002, to require vaccines for the union's approximately 260 members who are supervisory employees at the Illinois Department of Corrections. Pritzker mandated vaccinations for the state's healthcare workers, school personnel, and employees at government-operated facilities last month. And this agreement, this one is the first between his administration and the state's public unions, and it could serve as a blueprint to pave the way for vaccine mandates to move forward for thousands of government employees in other state offices, including the Illinois Department of Human Services and the Illinois Department of Veterans Affairs. Now, under the terms of this agreement, employees will be given a day off, compensated at their regular rate of pay to receive the jab, and those who fail to be fully inoculated by November will be subject to disciplinary measures that could ultimately result in discharge. In recent weeks, the legality of vaccine mandates on unionized employees has been contested, and many unions, not all of them, have opposed forced inoculations of their members. They say it's part of the collective bargaining process, and to their point, they're right. The State Police Association of Massachusetts, which represents 1,800 police officers in that state, filed a lawsuit against the Commonwealth to enjoin and prohibit from implementing a mandatory vaccination policy without first bargaining over the impact of its decision on the State Police Association of Massachusetts. So still some contention, not just some, a lot, depending on which union is involved. And lastly, some organizing news here. A little bit at a time, it's happening. Five workers, for example, at a Dollar General in Connecticut are unionizing with the United Food and Commercial Workers. Nearly 300 workers at the Minnesota Historical Society have filed paperwork to organize a wall-to-wall union on Monday. And workers at the University of Pittsburgh have launched a campaign to unionize thousands of staff members. Those employed by the university who are not faculty or graduate students at all five of the university's campuses. Another indication, especially with this pandemic, people are sick and tired of their working conditions and they want a union to represent them. All right, we have to break. When we come back, Bill Samuel, Government Affairs Director of the AFL-CIO.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
America's Workforce is being brought to you in part by the Communication Workers of America.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining,
atomic energy,
and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
The United Auto Workers are one of the largest and most diverse unions in North America, with members in virtually every sector of the economy. Learn more about this proud sponsor of our program at UAW.org.
Have you or a loved one been diagnosed with prostate, breast, or any other cancer after taking Zantac? You may be entitled to compensation. The trial lawyers at Kelly & Ferraro may be able to help you. Find us at kellyandferraro.com. Kelly & Ferraro, trial lawyers.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle, real simple, AWF Union Podcast. AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the Ohio Federation of Teachers, oh.aft.org. We had Melissa Cropper of the Ohio Federation on the show this past Tuesday, just 2 days ago. So you can check that podcast if you missed it. Speaking of the teachers, before we get to Bill Samuel, I want to mention here with school underway, amidst continuing teacher, parent, and student concern about the pandemic, Randy Weingarten, who heads the American Federation of Teachers, says governors who ban staff and kids from wearing masks are making schools unsafe. And while Randy didn't name names in her statement, which was entitled Schools Must Be Safe, Welcoming, and Open, the presidents of the AFT state affiliates in the two biggest culprit states, Texas and Florida, did. They've been speaking out. In both states, Governors Greg Abbott in Texas, Ron DeSantis in Florida, have vocally taken the lead against masks in schools, declaring that mandates, quote, infringe on individual liberty. And DeSantis has even gone so far as to threaten to yank state aid from Florida districts that defy his edict. Several sued to stop it, and that's in the courts right now. The edict also caught the Fed's attention. The Biden administration's Education Department of Civil Rights sent a formal letter to Florida this past Tuesday. The office is opening an investigation of Florida's masks in school ban violating civil rights of disabled students, who are among the most vulnerable to the coronavirus by exposing them to it. There's so much going on right now with regard to the pandemic. It's really difficult to sort out, but there's science and then there's the anti-science crowd. All right, let's go to line number one. Welcome a dear friend, longtime contributor to this show we call America's Workforce, Mr. Bill Samuel, who is the Government Affairs Director of the Labor Federation. Bill, welcome back to the show. I don't know how you keep your head on straight.
Well, you have to keep your gaze fixed on the end point. And I think there's going to be a deal here. And, you know, there could be a shutdown of the government for some brief period while they negotiate a deal. But I think they're going to work it out. That's my prediction. Take it for what it's worth.
That's just one of the things we're going to talk about today. I mean, we got the reconciliation bill. We've got Democrats who are not really Democrats. Usually they vote to lower drug prices. Now they're not. But the debt ceiling, let's get into that, because Mark Zandi, who's very prolific, and he's the chief economist at Moody's Analytics, he said if there is a prolonged impasse over the debt ceiling, it'll cost the U.S. economy 6 million jobs, wipe out $15 trillion in household wealth, and probably double the unemployment rate. And why don't you explain now the debt ceiling? Well, first of all, when is the deadline? When does this all happen?
Well, you know, it's a little bit subjective. I mean, the Treasury Secretary sort of keeps track of this, and they say it's going to happen sometime in October. And there are emergency measures they can take to extend it a little bit. You know, I'm sure the Fed has, you know, has some flexibility in how it borrows and spends to keep up with its debt, paying off the debt. But, you know, the point to make on this is that the debt ceiling is like your credit card. They've racked up the bills. Now the debt ceiling has to be raised just to pay it off. So these are bills that were racked up mostly during the previous administration, the big tax cut, you know, and some things that were worked out on a bipartisan basis, like the CARES Act. So that increased debt for good reason, good purpose. It kept us from going into a recession, which, by the way, would have piled on more debt. A lot of it gets kind of confusing here. But the point is, all raising the debt ceiling does is say, okay, now we're going to pay our credit card bill before we accumulate more debt.
Uh-huh.
And so this idea that it's up to only Democrats that Mitch McConnell has announced this new rule, you know, he keeps announcing new rules whenever it benefits Republicans, it's crazy. It's, you know, you talk about the bad effects of not raising the debt ceiling and the possibility of a recession, and, you know, then there's the possibility of government shutdown. You know, that always comes around to hurt Republicans more than Democrats. I hate to say it. I mean, to make it a partisan issue, but they're the anti-government party, and everybody knows it. Democrats, Republicans, independents. They run on that they're the anti-government party. Mm-hmm. So if the government shuts down or the debt ceiling isn't lifted and we go into a tailspin, they're going to get the blame. And I don't quite understand why McConnell doesn't get that. It's happened, you know, every time.
Here's what I don't understand. Why is McConnell calling the shots? He's not even in.
Yeah, that's a very good question. You know, he has a sort of an iron grip on his caucus or his conference. There's, you know, 50 Republicans. He's their leader, and he manages, you know, I think because they all think alike, and in some ways they're all sheep. You know, Democrats have independent thinkers. You mentioned there's a handful of Democrats who don't want to give Medicare the right to negotiate over prescription drug prices. Now, we disagree with them, but they've got their opinion. Mm-hmm. In the Republican Party, you're not allowed to have separate opinions. Look what happened to Liz Cheney, you know, and Adam Kinzinger, and others just stop running. You know, they drop out of Congress. You have a congressman from Ohio, Gonzalez, who just said, I'm not running. It's too poisonous. It's too toxic. It's too unsafe, he said, for his family. So, yeah, the Republicans, you know, they act like a you know, like an army, and in a very destructive way. But I think what comes around, you know, goes around, comes around. I think they're going to pay a big price for this.
So under the Trump administration, I'm reading that the national debt increased by close to $8 trillion. All right. $8 trillion. That's a chunk of money.
He stopped caring about the debt. You know, nominally a Republican, but he made it very clear he didn't care about deficit spending.
Uh-huh.
As long as it
went
to rich people. Yeah.
Okay. Now Biden wants to push this reconciliation bill, and this is the bill that's $3.5 trillion, and there's a lot of components which I want to break down here. So is that what the Republicans don't like. They don't want to. They don't want that to happen,
well,
and that's why they're going to hold up the government.
By the way, I mean, most of the $3.5 trillion, if we get there, maybe a little bit less, is going to be paid for by raising taxes, you know, on corporations and, you know, rich people like Jeff Bezos, who doesn't pay any taxes, you know, and Elon Musk. So the Democrats aren't adding to the deficit here. And by the way, it's not if you're adding to it for productive reasons, if you're putting people to work who are going to pay taxes, businesses are going to make profit, you know, when you fix the roads and invest in science, then it's not a bad thing to increase the debt. If you simply cut taxes and the government collects less, people, rich people invest in art and, you know, in yachts, you know, I suppose somebody had to build a yacht, but that's not all that productive. So Democrats are going to pay for most of what they want to spend, and what they don't pay for, you can make a very strong argument that it's not going to increase the debt over the long term. It's going to increase revenue. So McConnell did you talk about anti-science? They're also anti-economics. You know, they just make this stuff up. They say big government, deficit spending on the backs of your kids. You know, it's the same old. They've been doing this. I've been here for a few decades, and they do it every time we get to the end of the year and government's got to get a funding bill by September 30. And every few years, the debt ceiling has to be lifted. Although, by the way, I'm sure you've seen these charts. The debt usually goes down under Democrats. It went down under Clinton. It went down under Obama. And my guess is it'll go down under Biden. And usually, ordinarily, goes up under Republicans.
Well, yeah, Clinton balanced the budget, didn't he?
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, good example right there.
Democrats are willing to raise taxes to meet the needs of the American people and to spread the burden out fairly.
Yeah,
so rich people pay, corporations pay. This isn't, I hate to use this, it's not rocket science. There's a way to govern. It's, you know, a lot of countries in Western Europe have been doing this for decades, and they have much firmer social safety nets. There aren't as many homeless people, you know, people, you know, who can't afford food. I mean, it's, we have kind of a screwed up system here. But I think with Biden and Democrats in nominal control, I think they're going to figure out a way to get to the end game here in the next, you know, I would say maybe 10 days.
All right. What about the infrastructure bill? And I'm talking about the bipartisan one
right,
that passed in the Senate. And from all indication, that was supposed to be figured out this month. Like, and I mean, we're almost at the end of the September here. What's going on?
Yeah, the Speaker Pelosi agreed that they'd try to have a vote by September 27th. I take that to mean the week of September 27th, because the 27th, I think, is next Monday.
Right.
So next week, as you said, the Senate already passed it. And by the way, here's a fact. It got 19 Republican votes in the Senate. It really was bipartisan. And it spends about $1 trillion, $1.2 trillion, on roads, bridges, you know, water, clean water, broadband, electricity, you know, the grid, the electric grid. Good, strong, you know, infrastructure, kind of traditional bricks and mortar things. 19 Republicans voted for it. I think every Democrat voted for it. In the House, Kevin McCarthy is whipping against it because they're kind of, they want to see Biden fail. I mean, I can't put too fine a point on this. Uh-huh. They want to see this administration fail. They have no other reason. This is a bipartisan bill. It was a bipartisan bill in the Senate, and McCarthy is whipping against it because he doesn't want to see the president sign, you know, any legislation that's popular with the American people, and it is very popular with the American people. So that's one thing, and it's supposed to be voted on in the House next week, and Biden would love to sign it as soon as he could. And then at the same time, they're negotiating this budget reconciliation bill, which, you know, I know you want to get to, which is bigger. It's about three times bigger. And it's a little more in the social safety net area, paid leave, child tax benefits, dependent care. But there's some, you know, green jobs, auto jobs, there's some labor protections built into it, Davis-Bacon, some NLRB penalties, you know, some new things that we've been working on. That's all in the reconciliation bill. That's part of the budget process. That should be finished by now, but Republicans, again, are holding it up, so Democrats are going to have to do it on their own, you know, with no Republican votes. So Republicans don't want to pass either infrastructure or the budget reconciliation bill. They don't want to raise the debt ceiling. They won't probably agree to fund the government past the end of September. That's the end of the fiscal year. And Democrats are going to have to do it all. And because they have such narrow majorities, it's not going to be easy to get everybody on the same page. And I think that's Joe Biden's mission over the next couple of weeks. He was in Congress for 40 years. He knows how this is done.
Yeah, yeah. On the infrastructure bill, I want to go back to Kevin McCarthy. Now, he doesn't want it to happen. Does he have a lot of people that have the same belief that this is not a good thing, and they don't want him? They don't want Biden to win on anything?
Well, you know, Trump's been bad-mouthing it, although he was supposedly Mr. Infrastructure. I mean, this whole upside-down world that the Republicans are living in is hard to explain sometimes. But there will be some Republican votes. Some will break away from McCarthy, but not many. People think maybe 25. You know, they've got, 200 in their caucus?
Yeah.
So a handful will. But it's going to take Democrats, and there's a little bit of division on the Democratic side. We didn't get into that yet. There's a handful of Democrats, mostly progressives, saying, "I don't want to pass this bipartisan bill until we are sure we're going to get the budget reconciliation bill."
Oh,
you know,
boy.
With the climate provisions and the family issue, you know, family supports, paid leave, child care, dependent care, things like that. And I'm sympathetic to that. I mean, that, you know, you don't want to see one go and not the other, because we were all promised both bills, you know, months ago when this agenda was laid out. And I think we'll get both bills. I really do. As I said, I'm trying to be optimistic here. But it's going to take some work, and we got to make sure Democrats, at the end of the day, hang together. It's going to take everyone, all 50 Democrats in the Senate, and, you know, just about every House Democrat, I think, is, 222 now or something like that, and you need 218 to pass a bill in the House, so they can lose a handful, but no more.
Bill, I get it, going big, and there's a lot of people, the progressives want to go big to fix things. I mean, like going back to the FDR days, because there's a lot of people, and there's a lot of people that need the help, and I get the child care thing and all that. But don't you think it's a good idea to take one step at a time? Let's get this infrastructure thing done and then move on to the reconciliation bill. You mentioned how they want to tie the two together.
Yeah.
Don't you think it's better to work it that way?
Well, you know, I could argue either case. I think that we need both. Listen, we have a historic chance here with the Democrat. You know, the last time we had a Democratic majority in the House, Senate, and President, I think, was 2009 and 10 for 2 years. Obama was president. We still had the Congress. Before that, I think it was 2 years under Clinton, 92 and 94, and then we lost the House. So there aren't a lot of opportunities like this, just to put it in historical perspective. And we've got these mounting problems, you know, that are addressed in both bills. So I think Biden said, listen, I don't have a lot of time here. We got to make, you know, we got to use our majorities when we have them. This is what, and these are popular items. They're big investments, but they're good investments, and people support them. Republicans support them. Republican voters, that is. So I don't really begrudge them the strategy of sort of tying them together. But I think at the end of the day, they're not going to let either one fail. And I just think we have to let Nancy Pelosi, tacticians, people who understand how the House and Senate work, and the president, figure out how to get them both. So I'm not going to jump on the bandwagon of, I'm not going to sort of second guess their strategy, because I think we need both investments. By the way, just to put it in perspective, when Obama was president, we had the big fight over the stimulus. It was called the American Recovery and Something Act. Remember the ARRA?
Yeah, yeah.
It got us out of the recession. They argued for weeks, months, over an $800 billion bill. I think it ended up being $780-something billion. We're talking now about $1 trillion for infrastructure, $3+ trillion for the budget reconciliation bill, and earlier this year we already passed the $1.9 trillion rescue plan. So this really is historic. But I think it also matches the moment. It's what we need. I mean, I don't think this is sort of icing on the cake we're talking about here.
Yeah,
paid leave
is
something every other country has and has had for decades.
And, Bill, that's precisely why so many people are not going back to work right now, because they can't afford the salaries that are so low right now. Yeah, good point.
Low salaries and no daycare. You know, we don't have a national daycare system in this country, or a paid leave system. So, you know, you have a sick kid, a sick parent, a sick spouse. You got to decide, am I going to stay home and not get paid? Mm-hmm. At a time when people are, as you said, working for pretty lousy wages, you can't go without pay for 3 or 4 days. You can't pay your rent. You know, you could go on here. But I think we're at a historic moment here. And as I said, I'll go back to it again. I think the Democrats will figure it out. I could be wrong. You know, a month from now, we could be, like you said, Mark Zandi predicted, you know, in deep, you know, doo-doo. But I'm hoping that they know what they're doing. I think you got a lot of experienced hands here. As I said, Nancy Pelosi, Joe Biden, Chuck Schumer, they've been at this a long time.
Yeah,
they know their
yeah.
caucuses.
And the clock is ticking. This is going to happen very, very soon. All right, I got to take a quick break. Bill Samuel joining us on our live line. He's the Government Affairs Director for the AFL-CIO. Lots of good information posted at AFLCIO.org. Len DiCosimo of the Cleveland Federation of Musicians. That's Local 4 of the American Federation. He'll be joining us later in the show, and he's going to talk about vaccines in venues. That and more back in a few minutes.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
Mesothelioma is a rare type of cancer caused by exposure to asbestos. If you were exposed to asbestos and have mesothelioma or lung cancer, the trial lawyers at Kelly & Ferraro may be able to help you. Find us at KellyandFerraro.com. Kelly & Ferraro, trial lawyers.
Nurses, doctors, and caregivers at the VA are under attack. They face hostile management, callous agency heads, and an administration that's stomping all over their ability to speak up for our veterans. Unions are even being kicked out of their offices, a direct attempt to silence the voice of VA employees. When VA workers are under attack, veterans pay the price. Costly privatization and outsourcing will run rampant, meaning fewer services and worse quality of care for our nation's heroes. It's time to stand up for the workers who care for our veterans. Paid for by the American Federation of Government Employees.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at BoydWatterson.com.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, you can check us out on 5 platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, as well as Pandora. Let's go back to our live line. Rejoin Bill Samuel on behalf of the AFL-CIO. He is the Government Affairs Director. We're so lucky to have him because there's so many things to unwind in Washington right now. And he does a great job in helping all of us, including me, understand what's going on. I want to bring up this this drive here. Liz Shuler sent out an email the other day. Liz, of course, the president of the AFL-CIO, taking over after the passing of Rich Trumka about a month and a half ago. And she was talking about the PRO Act, tying it in with infrastructure investment and citizenship, talking about immigration reform, which is long, long overdue. And they sent out, this was a call to action day, to call the senators and try to tie all this together. Jobs with rights for all makes a whole lot of sense, especially with the immigrants in the country. They're taken advantage of. We know that story. That goes on a daily basis. So explain to me, this was part of the reconciliation bill, but one individual decided to take it out? What happened here, Bill?
Yeah, boy, I hope we have enough time to go through all this. So the budget reconciliation bill is a product of the 1974 Budget Act. And there are some rules about how it proceeds. And one of them is you can't filibuster it, because it's the budget, and the architects wanted to make sure there weren't, you know, games played, and that every year we'd have a budget and it would pass. So it only takes a bare majority, 50 votes, 50 plus one in the Senate. There's no such thing as a filibuster in the House. It just takes a majority there. But only certain things are allowed in the budget reconciliation bill. Only things that relate to the budget, that raise and or spend money. Now, you know, in years when we don't have enough Democrats to get to 60, which is how you normally pass legislation, you need to try to use reconciliation to get things passed.
Mm-hmm.
You just, you know, kind of stick things in there and hope that the parliamentarian who gets to rule, unelected appointed position, the Senate parliamentarian gets to rule. Does it fit the rules of reconciliation, budget reconciliation, or not? And there's something called the Byrd Rule, named after Senator Robert Byrd, who's no longer with us, who kind of defined what would fit in budget reconciliation. So the parliamentarian goes through this 2,500-page draft and says, this gets to stay, this doesn't, you've got to take this out. So on Sunday night, she ruled that provisions that were added by the Senate Judiciary Committee when they marked up their part of reconciliation to put about 8 million folks on a path to citizenship. These are essential workers, TPS, temporary protective status folks who are here under DACA, the deferred action, mostly kids. Many of them have been here for a long time. This provision would have given the right to get a green card and a work permit and be on a path to citizenship for about 8 million people. And the parliamentarian said, although that does affect the budget in a big way, it's really more about changing federal policy than a budget matter, so it's got to go. And she gets to make that call. It's sort of a bizarre feature of our democracy. Now, the Senate can overrule the parliamentarian, but it takes 60 votes. And there aren't 10 Republicans who will vote to overrule the parliamentarian on a matter like this. So, the advocates are trying to come up with another way to get this done as part of reconciliation, different language, different ways of sort of skinning the cat. And we'll see, maybe the next go at this. And there's a few more days to hassle it out. They can figure out a way to get past the parliamentarian. There are lots of other provisions in this 2,500-page draft that she's going to rule on over the next week or so, and others may come out, and we're kind of worried about that. We don't like this procedure very much. It's not very democratic. But that's what happened. So we're trying to, I think when President Shuler put out that call, she wanted to make sure that our allies in the immigration movement and immigrant workers know that we're fighting for them and doing everything we can.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting to note, too, that reconciliation bill, and you touched on this in the first segment, includes some labor protections. And I'm sure that's why the conservatives and the people like Mitch McConnell, Rand Paul, who really don't like unions, don't like what they see in that bill, which I'm reading would empower the NLRB to levy fines, substantial
That's
fines.
Right.
So what they've done here is they've taken some of the PRO Act and put it in the bill. Is that kind of what happened?
Yeah, this is really big news. I mentioned that the immigrant rights advocates put some immigration reform measures in. Well, our labor advocates, labor enforcement and workers' rights advocates in the Senate, put some labor provisions in reconciliation. And these would be new financial penalties imposed on companies, corporations that violate the National Labor Relations Act, that commit unfair labor practices. For 85 years, it's been okay to violate the NLRA, fire workers illegally, drag them into captive audience meetings, misclassify them as independent contractors, all the things that companies do, and they get away scot-free. I mean, I hate to say it, but everybody knows who's in this world. There are no financial sanctions under the National Labor Relations Act. It's a 90-year-old law. So for the first time, we have Democrats in the House and Senate who said, let's use reconciliation. We can raise money, it gets by the Byrd Rule, or it should, by imposing penalties. So this is going to come before the parliamentarian. And it's, by the way, it's $50,000 per violation. For a small, medium-sized company, that's serious. $100,000 for repeat offenders. And get this, these penalties can be imposed on corporate executives as individuals if they've knowingly participated in these violations. So this is a big deal. And this is in the PRO Act. We have some advocates who took it from the PRO Act and tried to put it in budget reconciliation. That's part of this big bill. And by the way, that's another reason, when you were saying, let's do this one at a time, let's get the infrastructure jobs, then worry about budget reconciliation. I get your point there, but budget reconciliation is really important to get done. And this is one of the reasons, because we're going to get, for the first time, if we can get past the parliamentarian, and she hasn't ruled yet, these penalties from the PRO Act, and we only need 50 votes. We don't need any Republicans to vote for budget reconciliation. We don't need any Republicans to vote for these new penalties.
As long as it's budget neutral, then, right?
Well, as long as it gets past the parliamentarian, it can raise money or it can cost money, as long as it's part of the budget resolution that set this whole thing up over the summer. It's a two-step process, but it should make it through. We're very hopeful, and that will be worth crowing about when the president signs his bill. If we get there, I'm optimistic we'll get there, but we're not there yet.
You got your fingers crossed, I know. All right, one more issue here. We got a couple minutes left. Voting. You know what's going on in various states. There's the For the People Act, and I guess they recrafted that. Any movement on making sure that we have free and fair elections in this country?
Yeah, I'm a little more pessimistic on that, but only a little. There is now, it was the For the People Act, which, you know, sets up federal standards for early voting, vote by mail, drop boxes, you know, all the things that states are cutting back on, the red states are cutting back on now to make it harder for, frankly, for black and brown people to vote. That's obviously what they're doing. They basically have admitted it. So this bill would say, no, states can't have their own rules about this. They have to be federal standards. It's now called the Freedom to Vote Act. They changed the name. And the reason they did that was because there were a couple that were Democratic senators who thought the bill went too far. Joe Manchin was one of them. I'm sure that name is becoming familiar to your listeners.
Oh, yeah.
So Democrats went back to the drawing board with him, and now Chuck Schumer says, we're going to call this the Manchin Compromise. We really invest Joe Manchin in this bill. So it's now done. We support it. The civil rights advocates support it. Voting rights advocates support it. It's called the Freedom to Vote Act. Three times already when the For the People Act came up, its precursor, Republicans filibustered it. You can't put this in budget reconciliation. This is sort of the usual legislative path things take. So Schumer has promised to bring the Freedom to Vote Act up later this month in October, and if Republicans filibuster it again, which we expect they will, there will be a serious discussion about changing the Senate rules and maybe restricting the ability of Republicans or the minority party to use the filibuster to block legislation. You asked a while ago, why does McConnell get to decide everything? Because he's got 50 votes, and as long as he keeps 40 of them, he can keep the Democrats from getting 60. Do the math. and break a filibuster. Again, budget reconciliation, you can't filibuster, so we only need 50. Everything else basically needs 60. And so this Freedom to Vote Act is going to have to get over that hurdle, or the Senate Democrats are going to have to agree to change the rules and make it impossible for the minority to block action on something as important as voting rights. So that's yet to come. We'll see that fight in later this month, well, probably October. It's already late September, so it'll be in October. So
I hear you.
More to come.
All right. Lots of fires burning right now. No doubt about that. Wow. Okay, buddy. You hang in there. Keep your head on straight. I know you're trying each and every day. It's not easy. And stay safe in the middle of this madness. Bill Samuel, Government Affairs Director of the AFL-CIO. Again, AFL-CIO.org, one of the many sponsors of this show, America's Workforce. Hang in there. We'll talk to you next month, buddy.
Thank
All right.
you.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Len DeCosimo, president of the American Federation of Musicians, Local 4.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as health care and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.
From the Golden Gate Bridge to the St. Louis Gateway Arch, the Sears Tower, and just about every building, bridge, and structure in between, our cities and towns wouldn't be the same without ironworkers. With over 3,000 contractors employing more than 130,000 highly trained ironworkers and 20,000 apprentices, the Ironworkers Union stands ready and able to shape the future of our skylines. Learn more at ironworkers.org. Ironworkers, the sky's the limit.
The United Steelworkers of America represent over 70,000 workers in the state of Ohio. Steelworker members enjoy the benefits of some of the best contracts of any workers in the world. Many of your friends, neighbors, and relatives are members of one of the most effective democratic unions in our country. With the pressures unorganized workers are under in today's economy, you need to join them. So call the Steelworkers Organizing Office at 216-292-5683 or toll free at 1-800-443-3752.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferentz with America's Workforce.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle is at AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the North Coast Area Labor Federation. Speaking of which, let's go to line number two right now. And joining us, great guy, Len DeCosimo, who is the treasurer of the North Coast Area Labor Federation, is also president of the American Federation of Musicians Local 4 in Northeastern Ohio. Len DeCosimo, how are we doing today, brother?
That's me. I'm fine, Flash. How are you?
I'm good. Trying to navigate through the craziness in this world today. We just got off the phone with Bill Samuel of the AFL-CIO. I don't know how that guy, because there's so much legislation that's just going through Washington right now. Good legislation, but you know how that is. It's always being batted down.
He must feel like a hamster on a wheel lately.
You're not
really
kidding.
He's doing good work, and there is a lot of legislation that needs our attention.
Yeah. Speaking of which, American Rescue Plan helped you guys out, right? And all the in the venues here, that was long overdue, right?
You know, the grants that come for the fine arts through the American Rescue Plan have been a real boon to the arts sector. You know, it's not just the Shuttered Venue Operators Grant, which helped, you know, live venue operators, promoters, producers, the arts organizations, even museums and motion picture and theater operators were helped with that. There's also another grant through the U.S. Economic Development Administration through the American Rescue Plan called the Build Back Better Regional Challenge. And there's seven different programs you can apply for. And a couple of them will affect the fine arts sector. Again, there's a travel tourism and outdoor recreation one, too. It's interesting that this side of the American Rescue Plan also has good grants for indigenous communities and the coal communities. So the Biden administration is really looking broader than just the usual sectors that get attention.
Len, talk to me about the venues. Many of them that were closed down are now opened up. Playhouse Square opened up recently. Cleveland Orchestra is back performing, and with certain precautions, and maybe you could speak to that because you represent the members of the Cleveland Orchestra, world-renowned orchestra, I might add. But how's everything panning out? Because are there mandates for vaccines and masks? Maybe you can run that down for us.
Well, sure. For the performance venues, we'll take, for example, the two you just mentioned, our two in Northeast Ohio, Severance Hall and Playhouse Square Foundation, for the patrons, they're going to need to provide either a proof of vaccination or a negative test for COVID. The time frame on that test varies per venue. But I will say this in terms of the patron response, it's more than just the effect on single ticket sales. There's also subscriptions and group sales in addition to the single tickets that were sold before this decision was made. And while there's, you know, great relief and congratulations for the positions that the venues are taking, there's also cancellations on the other side of that coin. And, discretionary income is going to be gained and lost as we continue to go through this plague. I know that for patrons, masks at all time, except when consuming food or beverage, that seems to be the norm in so many places. For our members at Local 4, the music union, we also have settlements that we're working on. In fact, we were just completing ours with the orchestra this week that not only address vaccination, and it also affects potential booster shots coming ahead. This is still unwinding for all of us, Flash, and it's going to be interesting to see how everybody responds. You know, and for the most part, our musicians are very comfortable with these new mandates.
Yeah.
You know, we worry about our health, you know, like everybody else.
Everybody should be worried about their health. No doubt. No doubt. Follow the science, I keep saying. So this is also a landmark year for Local 4. You're going to be celebrating. Well, you're in the midst of celebrating. What is it? 125 years? Is that right?
Hey, this is our 125th anniversary. We were chartered November 15, 1896. You know, Flash, the Midwest organized the musicians. We're Local 4. Detroit is 5. Cincinnati's Local 1. Indianapolis is Local 3. St. Louis is Local 2. It was us in the heartland that organized the musicians. And one of the fun things that I found out is that our bylaws, even though we were chartered November 15th, our bylaws read that we're to celebrate the anniversary on December 4 of each year. I don't know why. We're having concerts all around the city. November 19 at the Bop Stop, December 1 at the Beachland Ballroom, December 11 at the Bohemian National Hall north of Slavic Village. What a beautiful space that is. We're going to feature vocalists, jazz musicians at the Bop Stop. At the Beachland, it's going to be great. We're going to feature songwriters. There's a young songwriter we're all hot on named Ray Flanagan. Brent Kirby will be featured. I know you play some of his bumper music. We're going to have Alex Bevan and friends come. And we're going to end the program by honoring the Numbers Band. The reason we're doing that is because 25 years or so ago, the Numbers Band did a gig. They had their equipment stolen. The community came out. We raised money at a concert. Then the equipment was found. And the Numbers Band donated the proceeds of that concert to the Music Union for a benevolent society. And that's the Music Relief Fund that we've been raising money for since the plague began. We've given over $80,000 to our local members since the plague began. And it's all because of that generosity of the Kidney Brothers, Terry Hind, Bill Watson on bass, Clint Aguirre on drums, the Numbers Band. They're just an institution here in Northeast Ohio.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. My God, 1560-75, the Numbers Band.
Amen.
And if you Google that, you can see that they're celebrating a half century here, 50 years in the field of music. Great stuff there. And 125 years for Local 4. So that means you surviving because there's two pandemics in that time period. You got 1918, 1919.
That's right. I don't remember the 1918 pandemic. I'll have to shuffle through my memory to see what we did back then.
Oh my God.
It's all a part of, understanding where we are. It's funny, in our industry, in organized labor, when you're negotiating, when you're rallying for rights, we all get to the fight so quickly, Flash. And we do that. We do it well because we demand our rights. There's also a need to balance that with responsibility to your family, to your community. And I think that's a part of what this vaccination position is for so many of us, particularly in this industry. We were the first ones out, and we're going to be the last ones coming back in.
Yeah, you're right.
This season, so many of us are on an academic calendar, and this 21-22 season is going to be the third year where the plague has affected us. The fine arts in general on academic calendars have not had a full complete season since the 2018-2019 season. That's significant for our industry, and we want to bring more attention to that.
Lots going on. Len, it's always a pleasure having you on the show. Let's drive people to your website. That's Local 4, the number 4, AFM.org. And you can follow them on Twitter. Twitter handle is at Local 4, AFM. And you can also check them out on Facebook at CFM, as in Cleveland Federation of Musicians, Local 4, CFM. Local 4. Looking forward to all these live events happening, and congratulations on that 125 years, Mr. DeCosmo. So you stay safe and stay in touch, all right?
Thanks, brother. Let's keep going doing good work.
You got it. All right. That's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up tomorrow, our segment on working class perspectives and the United Steelworkers. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening. And be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.